the two transactions quite well. He thought the lady was Mrs. Ratcliffe, and he was sure from his conversation with him that the man was Sorrel himself. Yes, he thought he would recognize Mr. Sorrel again. Grant produced the Dago's photograph and showed it to him. "Is that the man?" he asked. The clerk shook his head. "Never saw him before, to my knowledge," he said. "That, then?" asked Grant, handing over Sorrel's photograph, and the clerk immediately recognized it. "Did he inquire about his neighbors in the row?" Grant asked. But the clerk could recall no details like that. It had been a very busy day that Monday. Grant thanked him and went out into the drizzle, quite unaware that it was raining. Things were no longer reasonable and understandable, cause and effect, motive and action decently allied. They were acquiring a nightmare inconsequence that dismayed his daytime brain. Sorrel had intended to go to America after all. He had booked a second-class passage and personally chosen the cabin. The amazing and incontrovertible fact did not fit in anywhere. It was a very large wrench thrown into the machinery that had begun to run so smoothly. If Sorrel had been as penniless as he seemed, he would not have contemplated a second-class journey to New York, and in view of the booking of the passage, contemplated suicide seemed a poor explanation for the presence of the revolver and absence of belongings. It shouted much more loudly of his first theory, that the lack of personal clues had been arranged in case of a brush with the police. But Sorrel had, to all accounts, been a law-abiding person. And then, to crown things, there was Mrs. Ratcliffe's reappearance in the affair. She had been the only one of the people surrounding Sorrel to show marked distress at the time of the murder or afterwards. It was she and her husband who had avowedly been next behind Sorrel in the queue. Her husband, a picture of James Ratcliffe, that prop of British citizenship, swam into his mind. He would go and have another, and totally unheralded, interview with Mr. Ratcliffe. The boy took in his card, and he waited in the outer office for perhaps 3 minutes before Mr. Ratcliffe came out and drew him in with a welcoming affability. "Well, Inspector," he said, "how are you getting on? Do you know, you and dentists must be the most unhappy people in the world. No one sees you without remembering unpleasant things." "I didn't come to bother you," Grant said. "I just happened to be round, and I thought you'd perhaps let me use your telephone to save me going to a post office." "Oh, certainly," said Ratcliffe. "Carry on, I'll go." "No, don't go," said Grant. "There'll be nothing private. I only want to know whether they want me." But no one wanted him. The scent in South London was weak, but the hounds were persevering and busy, and he hung up with a relief which was rather surprising when one considered the eager frame of mind in which he had set out from the yard. Now he did not want an arrest until he had time to think things over for a bit. The nightmare of a Scotland Yard officer's whole life is wrongful arrest. He turned to Ratcliffe and allowed him to know that an arrest was imminent. They had located their man. Ratcliffe was complimentary, and in the middle of the compliments, Grant said, "By the way, you didn't tell me that your wife had intended sailing for New York the night after the murder." Ratcliffe's face, clear in the light of the window, was both blank and shocked. "I didn't know," he began, and then with a rush, "I didn't think it was of any importance, or I should have told you. She was too much upset to go, and in any case there was the inquest. She has a sister in New York, and was going over for a month, just. It didn't make any difference, did it? Not knowing, I mean. It had no bearing on the crime." "Oh, no," Grant said. "I found it out quite accidentally. It is of no consequence. Is your wife better?" "Yes, I think so. She hasn't been at home since the inquest. She's at Eastbourne with the other sister, the one you met, I think." Still more puzzled, Grant made his way back to the yard. He pressed the button on his desk and said to the man who answered it, I want someone for special work. Is Simpson in?
Yes, sir.
Send him in. A fair and freckled man of medium height arrived. He had the pleased, alert air of a terrier who was waiting for someone to throw a stone. To him, Grant said, At 54 Lemonora Road, Golders Green, live a Mr. and Mrs. Ratcliffe. I want to know what terms they are on, with each other, I mean. Also, anything else you can learn about the household. The gossipier, the better. I know all about his business, so you needn't waste time on that. It's his home affairs that I want to know about. You can use any method you like as long as you keep within the law. Report to me tonight whether you have got anything or not. Is Mullins in the yard just now?
Yes, Simpson had seen him as he came up.
Well, send him to me.
Mullins was not freckled, and he looked rather like a verger.
Good morning, sir, he said, and waited.
Good morning, Mullins. From now until further notice, you are a peddler. You make an excellent Italian, but I think perhaps you'd better be British. It's less conspicuous. I'll give you a chit to Clitheroe in Landers Street, and he will give you the kind of stock I want. Don't sell more than you can help, and I don't want you to come back here. Meet me in the alley by Clitheroe's in an hour from now. Can you manage it in an hour?
I think so, sir. Am I young or old?
It doesn't matter. Young to middle-aged. Greybeards are too theatrical. Don't overdo anything. Respectable enough to travel on a bus if need be.
Very good, sir, said Mullins, as though his instructions had been to post a letter.
When Grant stumbled across him in the alley in Lowndes Street an hour later, he said,
You're a wonder, Mullins, simply a wonder. I should never believe you had ever written a report in your life if I didn't know firsthand.
He looked appreciatively at the peddler before him. It was incredible that that slightly drooping figure was one of the most promising men at the yard. It is very seldom that the CID resort to disguise, but when they do it well. Mullins had the supreme touch, that faculty of looking as though he could not possibly be other than he was at the moment. His clothes, even though obviously third-hand, had not that uneasy fit that newly donned garments have. They lay to his shoulders as a much-worn garment does, however ill-fitting.
"Like a trinket, sir," said Mullins the peddler, opening the lid of his wicker tray. On the baize lining lay a collection of articles, mostly of cheap Italian manufacture, paper knives, painted wood ornaments of all sorts, useful and useless, papier-mâché bowls, stucco figures.
"Good," said Grant. He took from his pocket a thin thing wrapped in tissue paper. As he unrolled the paper, he said, "I want you to go to 98 Breitling Crescent, off the Fulham Road, and find out if the woman who lives there has ever seen this before." He laid a silver dagger with an enamelled handle down among the painted wood and the stucco. Needless to say, it isn't for sale. What's the price of this? He added, picking up an article.
Give that to a gentleman like you for 1 and 9, said Mullins without hesitation.
As the passer-by went beyond hearing, Grant continued cheerfully, as if there had been no parenthesis. When you've disposed of the woman in Breitling Crescent, and keep your eyes open generally, go to 54 Lemonora Road and see if anyone there recognizes it. Report as soon as you have finished. When the peddler of Italian goods reached the back door of 54 Lemonora Road about tea-time, a pretty but capless maid said,
"Goodness, here's another."
"Another what?" said the peddler.
"Another man selling things."
"Oh, been a lot.
Bet they hadn't anything like mine," he said, and opened the tray.
"Oh," she said, obviously enraptured. "Are they dear?"
"Not them. Besides, a girl with wages like yours can easily afford something nice."
"What do you know about my wages, mister?"
"Well, I don't know anything. I'm just deducing. Pretty girl, nice house, good wages."
"Oh, the wages are good enough," she said in a tone that indicated other shortcomings.
"'Wouldn't a lady of the house like to have a look at them?' he said.
"'There's no lady,' she said. "'I'm the lady of the house just now. "'The missus is at Eastbourne. "'You been in the army?'
"'I was in the army during the war. "'That's the only time been in the army counts. "'France? I was 4 years in France, miss.'
"'Well, you can come in and have some tea "'and let me see the things properly. "'We're just in the middle of it.'
She led him into the kitchen, where the table was spread with butter, bread, several kinds of jam and cake. At the table, with an enormous cup of tea halfway to his mouth, was a freckled fair man with a blue muffler and a discharged soldier's silver badge on his lapel. Beside him on the table was a pile of cheap writing pads.
"'This is another ex-service man,' the maid said. "'He's selling writing paper. I shouldn't think there's much sale for it now. It's ages since I've seen someone round selling pads.'
"'How do, mate?'
said the freckled one, meeting the quizzical regard of the peddler with complete equanimity.
"'How's trade?'
"'Fair, just fair. You seem to be very comfortable.'
"'Well, I needed it.
Haven't sold a pad today.
This country's going to the dogs.' It's something to come across someone now and again who has a heart.
Have some jam, said the maid, pushing his cup of tea across to the peddler,
and he helped himself liberally.
Well, I'm glad the missus isn't at home in one way, but I'm sorry in another. I thought as though she might buy something too.
Well, I'm not sorry, she said. It's a blessed relief. What with her airs and her tantrums, life isn't worth living.
Got a temper, has she?
Well, I call it temper, but she calls it nerves. And ever since this murder affair, she was in the queue that night the man was murdered, you know. Yes, stood right up against him. And oh, what a to-do! And then she had to go to the inquest and give evidence. If she'd done the murder herself, she couldn't have kicked up a bigger fuss about going. The night before she was screaming and howling and saying she couldn't stand it. And when the poor master tried to quiet her down, she wouldn't let him go near. Hurling names at him you wouldn't use to a dog. I tell you, it wasn't half a relief when she went off to Eastbourne with Miss Lethbridge. That's her sister.
"'Yes, the best thing they can do when they're like that is to go away for a bit,' said the freckled man. "'Does she go often?'
"'Not so often as I'd like, believe me. "'She was going to Yorkshire the day after the murder, and then was so upset that she couldn't go. "'Now she's gone to Eastbourne instead, and long may she stay there, say I. "'Let's see your stuff,' she said to the peddler.
"'He jerked his head at the tray.'
Have a look for yourself. Anything you fancy, you can have cheap. It's a long time since I had tea like this. What say, Bill?
Ah, agreed his fellow itinerant through a large mouthful of cake.
It isn't often people has a heart.
She gloated over the bright-coloured collection a while.
Well, the missus is missing something, she said. She's mad on curios and such like things that hold the dust. Artistic she is. What's this for?
She said, holding up the dagger.
Murdering people with. Ain't you ever seen one like that before? The peddler said in astonishment. That's a paper knife, same as the wooden ones.
She tried the point absently on a fingertip, and with a queer little shudder of disgust that was quite involuntary, she put it down again. In the end, she chose a little painted bowl, quite useless, but very gay to look upon. The peddler let her have it for sixpence, and in her gratitude she produced cigarettes of Mr. Ratcliffe's, and while they smoked, enlivened them with talk of what was obviously uppermost in her mind—the murder.
"'We had an inspector of police here, if you'd believe it. Quite nice-looking he was. You'd never say he was a policeman. Not coarse like a bobby.' But it wasn't nice all the same having him round. Of course he was suspicious, with her carrying on like that and not wanting to see him. I heard Miss Lethbridge say to her, "Don't be a fool, Meg. The only way to stop him is to see him and convince him.
You've got to do it.
Well, Eastbourne's a nice place, said the freckled man. She'll have company there to forget her troubles.
Oh, she's not one for company much. Always having crazes for someone or other, and then she runs them to death and has someone new. Boys as often as not. She's queer, she is.
When her talk began to be repetitive instead of informative, the freckled man stood up and said,
Well, miss, I ain't had such a tea not in years, and I'm real grateful to you.
You're welcome, she said. If you take my advice, you'll give up the writing pad business. There's nothing in it nowadays. It's old-fashioned. Try stuff like him there. Novelty stuff, like they sell in the shops at Christmas time.
The freckled man's glance fell sardonically on the dagger among the Christmas goods.
You going up the road or down? He said to the peddler.
Up, said the peddler.
Well, cheerio, I'll be going. Many thanks again for the tea, miss.
And the door closed behind him. 5 minutes later, the peddler took his leave.
If I was you, miss, I wouldn't be so free with my teas, he said. There's lots of decent chaps on the road, but there's lots of the other kind, too. You can't be too careful when you're alone in the house.
Are you jealous of the freckly man?
She asked coquettishly, and quite unimpressed.
You needn't be. I didn't buy a pad, you know.
Well, well, said the peddler, frustrated in his good intentions, and went lagging down the path to the gate.
By sheer chance, he found the freckled man occupying the front outside seat of the bus he boarded.
Well, said that worthy cheerily, had a good day, mate?
Rotten, said the peddler, just rotten.
How you been doing?
Fair.
Isn't it amazing, he said, seeing that the bus stop behind them was deserted. What fools these girls are. Why, we could have polished her off and made away with everything in the house, and it never seemed to occur to her. I said as much to her when I was going, but she thought I was jealous of you.
Of me?
It should be the other way about. She didn't buy a pad.
So she pointed out.
That was a good stock you had.
The boss chose it.
Yes. Thought so. He's a daisy. What's he nosing out there?
Don't know.
The girl didn't fall for the knife, I noticed.
No.
The peddler was not communicative. The freckled one resigned himself.
Chatty bird, he remarked, and drawing two cigarettes from the recesses of his person, he handed one to his companion.
The peddler cast an idle glance at the maker's name and recognized it as one of Mr. Ratcliffe's. His stern features relaxed into a smile.
"Scrounger," he said, and held his cigarette to the offered match.
But there was nothing of the freebooter in the reports which Mullins and Simpson presented to Grant an hour later. Simpson said that Mr. and Mrs. Ratcliffe lived on amicable terms, with intervals of very severe squall. Simpson was unable to say whether the squall was started by Mr. Ratcliffe's shortcomings or by Mr. Ratcliffe's resentment of his wife's, since the maid was never present at the beginning of a quarrel. What she heard through a shut door, usually. The biggest row had occurred when they came home on the night of the murder. Since then, they had not been on friendly terms. Mrs. Ratcliffe had intended to go to Yorkshire the day after the murder, but was too upset to go, and after the inquest she and her sister had gone down to Eastbourne, where she was now at the Grand Parade Hotel. She was a person who took sudden and violent likings for people, and during the time she liked them would be quite unreasonable about them. She had a little money of her own and was rather independent of her husband. Mullins said that at 98 he had had difficulty in making Mrs. Everett interested enough to allow him to open his tray. She had insisted that she wanted nothing. When he did uncover his wares, the first thing her eyes had lighted on was the dagger. She had immediately cast a glance full of suspicion at him and had said,
go away, and shut the door in his face. What do you think? Did she know it? Mullins could not say, but it was the sight of it that had made her shut the door like that. She had been going to put up with him until she saw the knife. The maid at Lemonora Road had never seen it before, that he was sure of. When he had dismissed Mullins and locked away the knife in its drawer again, Grant sat thinking for a long time. This was an unlucky day. There had been no arrest, though he was inclined to think of that as a mixed blessing. There had been the stunning discovery that Sorrel had really meant to go to America, and there had been no trace of the banknotes handed over to Lamont with the rest of the £223, of which the 25 sent by the unknown friend had been part. It was 7 days since the murder, and the notes had been handed out 10 days before that, and not one of them, apart from the 25 in their possession, had been traced. Moreover, his two scouts had brought in nothing of importance. In no way could he account for a connection between Mrs. Ratcliffe and Sorrel. He was inclined to think it sheer coincidence that had put their names together in a ship's list and had placed them together in the queue. Her husband's appearance of shock, when Grant had mentioned the departure for New York, might have been merely the result of the recollection that he had omitted to tell the inspector of his wife's intended departure. As for Mrs. Everett, her sudden withdrawal spoke more of intelligence than guilt. Mullins had said that she looked at him suspiciously. She had made no attempt to carry off the situation with a high hand by ignoring the dagger or by wantonly calling attention to it. She had been merely suspicious. He decided to give the Everett woman a few more marks for intelligence and to acquit her of complicity. As for the Ratcliffes, he would temporarily cut them out. They didn't fit, and there was no evidence. Things often fit to the police satisfaction when there is no evidence whatever, but here things neither fitted nor were backed by evidence, and consequently would have to stand aside. Presently he would find out why Mrs. Ratcliffe had told her maid that she was going to Yorkshire when she intended to go abroad. The telephone buzzed. Grant took it up with an eagerness of which he was not conscious. It was Williams. "We've located him, sir. Would you like to come, or shall we carry on?" "Where is it?" Williams told him. "Have you got the exits all secured? No chance of failure if we hang on for a little?" "Oh, no, sir. We've got him all right." "In that case, meet me at the Brixton Road end of Acre Lane in half an hour." When he joined his subordinate, he asked for details, and Williams supplied them as they went along. He had found his man through the house agents. Lamont had engaged a furnished top flat, 2 small rooms, 3 days before the murder, and had moved in on the actual day of the murder in the morning. Yes, thought Grant, that fitted Mrs. Everett's story. "What name did he give?" he asked. "His own," Williams said. "What? His own name?" repeated Grant incredulously, and was silent, vaguely troubled. "Well, you've done well, Williams, to run him down so soon. Shybird, is he?" "He is," said Williams with emphasis. "Even yet I can't get anyone to say that they've seen him. Shy's the word. Here we are, sir. The house is the 4th in the terrace from here." "Good," said Grant. "You and I will go up. Got a shooter in your pocket in case?" "All right, come on." They had no latch-key, and there was apparently no bell for the 3rd floor. They had to ring several times before the inhabitants of the ground floor came grumbling to their rescue and admitted them. As they ascended the increasingly shabby stairs and the last of the daylight, Grant's spirits rose, as they always did at the point of action. There would be no more pottering round. He was about to come face to face with the Dago, the man he had seen in the Strand, the man who had stuck Sorrel in the back. He knocked abruptly at the door in the shadows. The room beyond sounded hollow and empty. There was no answer. Again Grant knocked, with no result. You might as well open it, Lamont. We're police officers, and if you don't open it, we'll have to burst in.
Still a complete silence. You're sure he's here? Grant asked Williams.
Well, he was here yesterday, sir, and no one's seen him since. The house has been under observation since 3 this afternoon.
We'll burst the lock, then, Grant said, and don't forget to stand back when the door goes in.
With their combined weight, they attacked the door, which gave up the unequal struggle with a groaning crash, and Grant, with his right hand in his pocket, walked into the room. One glance round him told him the truth, and he suddenly knew that ever since he had arrived on the landing, outside, he had had a conviction that the rooms were empty.
"The bird's flown, Williams. We've missed him."
Williams was standing in the middle of the floor, with the expression of a child from whom a sweet has been taken. He swallowed painfully, and Grant, even in the middle of his own disappointment, found time to be sorry for him. It wasn't Williams' fault. He had been a little too sure, but he had done well to locate the man so quickly.
"Well, he went in a hurry, sir," said Williams,
as if that fact were a palliative to his own hurt pride and disappointment. And certainly there was every evidence of haste. Food was left on the table, drawers were half open and obviously ransacked, clothing had been left behind, and many personal possessions. It was not a methodical getaway, it was a flight.
"We'll go through what he has left behind," Grant said. "I'll test for fingerprints before we have to light the lights. There seems to be nothing but the lamp for illumination."
He went round the two rooms with his light powder, but there were few surfaces in the flat on which a print was likely to show clear and unmistakable, and these were so patterned over with prints as to be unproductive. But fairly high up on the varnished wood of the door, where a person's left hand would rest as his right took a coat from the hooks nailed there, were two good prints. A little consoled, Grant lit the lamp and went through the things Lamont had left behind. An exclamation from Williams in the bedroom took him there. Williams was holding a wad of Bank of England notes.
"Got them at the back of this drawer, sir. He did go in a hurry."
Balm was flowing on Williams' excoriated soul. "Won't he be biting himself?" But Grant was searching in his pocketbook, and presently produced a list of numbers which he compared with those on the notes. Yes, there was no doubt about it. These were the notes that Lamont had drawn with the check he had had from Sorrel, and Lamont had been so hurried in his flight that he had actually forgotten a thing so vital. The whole amount was there, except for the £25 sent for Sorrel's burial. That was rather extraordinary. Why had the Dago, as Grant continued to think of him, spent none of it in the 10 days between the time he had received it and the murder? There had been no need of fear then, surely. The value of the notes was large, but that was no explanation. The man had drawn the money himself, and could have had the whole amount in treasury notes if he had so wanted. Why had he spent none of it? There was little else in the flat to interest them. The man had a Catholic taste in literature, Grant thought, looking along the single row of books that adorned the mantelpiece. Wells, O. Henry, Buchan, Owen, Wister, Mary Roberts, Reinhardt, Sassoon's poems, many volumes of the annual edition of Racing Up to Date, Barry's Little Minister. He took down one and opened it. On the flyleaf in the writing he had seen on the check at the bank was the owner's name, Albert Sorrel. He took down the others one by one. Nearly all of them had belonged to Sorrel. They had evidently been bequeathed to Lamont by Sorrel on his departure for the United States. Up to the last minute, then, these two men had been friendly. What had happened? Or was it only an outward friendship? Had Lamont always been a snake in the grass? And now there was the new problem of Lamont's present hiding place. Where would he be likely to go? He was in a hurry, a desperate hurry.
It was no planned affair. That meant that he had probably had to take what refuge came his way. There was no need for them to consider any such possibility as an escape abroad in an elaborate disguise. He had not done that, certainly. He had almost certainly not gone out of London. He would, as he had done before, stick rat-like to the place he knew. Grant left instructions that the search was to go on as before, and went back to the yard, trying to put himself in the wanted man's place, in the hope of working out a line of flight. It was very late at night, and he was very weary, when at last he found light on the matter. The photographs of the prints he had found on the door were sent to him, and the prints were Mrs. Everett's. There was no doubt of it. That first finger that had left a mark at the back of Sorrel's photograph in the little room at the Brightling Crescent belonged to the hand that had leaned against the door in the effort of reaching for something in Lamont's room. Mrs. Everett. Good heaven! Talk of snakes in the grass! And he, Grant, should really retire. He had got to the stage of trusting people. It was incredible and humiliating, but he had believed Mrs. Everett was being straight with him. His putting a man to watch her had been the merest form. Well, it was a bad break, but he had his line on Lamont now. He would get him through Mrs. Everett. He did not doubt for a moment that it was information furnished by Mrs. Everett that had stirred Lamont into flight. She had probably gone straight to him after he had left her yesterday evening. She was gone before the watcher arrived, but he should have seen her come back. That would have to be looked into. Andrews was careless. And in all probability, she had either suggested or provided the new hiding place. He did not believe that a woman of her intelligence would be fool enough to believe that she could keep Lamont hiding at Brightling Terrace. Therefore, he had now to find out all about Mrs. Everett and all the ramifications of the Everett family. How should he do it? What was the best avenue of approach to a woman of Mrs. Everett's moated and castellated type? No back-door business, anyhow. She was not a door-gossiper, evidently, and now she was on her guard. That effort to stampede her into a show of emotion had been both futile and ill-advised. He might have known that she wasn't the woman to give anything away in a back-door conversation. Well, what then? In what kind of society, on what kind of occasion, if any, did Mrs. Everett open out? He visualized her in various surroundings and found her invariably grotesque. And then he suddenly had it. Church. The woman shrieked, church worker. She would be greatly respected by all the congregation, but very slightly unpopular because she kept herself to herself, a quality little beloved by the earnest members of work parties and such Christian activities who, having provided a titbit, such as a rumoured bankruptcy among the flock, expect to be offered a decently sized and tolerably luscious titbit in return. Church had placed her, and since she was most certainly not over-popular, her fellow worshippers would be all the more ready to talk about her. As Grant's eyes closed in sleep, he was deciding whom to send to investigate Mrs. Everett. Chapter 10 The Burst to the North. "Simpson," said Grant, "what were you yesterday when you were gathering information about the Ratcliffes?"
"I was an ex-serviceman with writing pad, sir."
"Oh, well, you can be an ex-serviceman again today. Very self-respecting, clean, with a collar, not a muffler, and out of a job. I want to know about a Mrs. Everett, who lives at 98 Brightling Crescent, off the Fulham Road. I don't want any door-to-door business. She's shy of that, and you must be very careful. She looks as if she attends church. Try that. I think you should find it useful. Bar a club. It's the gossipiest community I know of. I want to know, above all, where her friends and relations live. Never mind her correspondence. I can keep an eye on that myself. and in any case, I have an idea that that isn't likely to be useful. Mrs. Everett was not born yesterday. Get that into your head and remember it. Don't work faster than you can with safety. If she spots you, it will mean that someone else will have to take over, and a promising line of investigation will be spoiled. The minute you get something, let me know, but don't come back here until you've talked to me on the telephone first. That was how Mr. Caldecott, the clergyman of the Brightlingside Congregational Church, pushing damply at the mower which jibbed at the tough grass of his front lawn, and finding the March sun too prodigal of its blessing, became aware that his labours were being viewed by a stranger with a queer mixture of sympathy and envy. Seeing that he had been discovered, the stranger made a sketchy motion towards his cap, in deference, evidently, to the cloth, and said, "That's hot work on a day like this, sir. Will you let me take a hand?" Now the clergyman was young and very fond of showing that he was not above a good day's work. "Do you think I'm not able to do a job like that myself?" he asked, with a strong brotherly smile. "Oh, no, sir, it isn't that at all. It's only that I'd be very glad to earn a copper or two for doing it for you." "Oh," said Mr. Caldecott, his professional instincts aroused, "are you looking for work?" "That's about it," said the man. "Married?" "No, sir." Simpson was about to add a pious thanksgiving, but stopped himself in time. "What kind of work are you looking for?"
"Anything."
"Yes, but have you a trade?"
"I can make shoes, sir," said Simpson, thinking he might as well stick to the truth as far as it served him.
"Well, perhaps it would be more sensible if you did the grass and I attended to other duties. Come in and have lunch with me at 1 o'clock." But that was not at all what Simpson wanted. The kitchen was his objective, not the parsonical conversation of the dining-room. With a masterly confusion, he turned hesitatingly from the mower on which he had already laid zealous hands, and stammered,
"If it's all the same to you, sir, I'd rather have a bite in the kitchen. You see, I'm not used to the other kind."
"Come, come," began Mr. Caldecott, in brotherly rallying, and Simpson, fearful that his chance of precious gossip was going to be taken from him, could have hit the reverend gentleman.
"Please, sir, if you don't mind," he said, with such a wealth of conviction in his tone that the clergyman gave way.
"Well, well," he said, half-testily. Had he not exhibited broad-mindedness and the true spirit of brotherhood and had them discounted? "If you really would prefer it." He went away, but before very long he came back, and under pretext of hearing Simpson's history— he catalogued his visitor, in a completely unbrotherly fashion, as a very respectable fellow. He remained on the pathway until lunchtime, gossiping cheerfully about the things that interested him. He talked about the war. He had been a CF at Rouen. About seedlings and London soot and shoe leather, this last as being of possible interest to his listener, and the difficulty he experienced in getting young men to come to church. When Simpson found that his last sermon had proved conclusively that God disapproved of betting, and that those who betted committed a sin against themselves, against their neighbour, and against God, he was not particularly surprised at the paucity of Mr. Caldecott's youthful following.
"Now you are young," Mr. Caldecott said. "Can you tell me why young men do not like church?"
But Simpson had no intention of leaving the clergyman's house before evening, if he could help it, so he refrained from instructing him and merely shook his head sadly to indicate mournful disapproval. A consciousness of the weekly half-crown that went to enrich the bookmakers instead of the managers of the local empire made him attack his work with a new zeal. But he was glad when a gong sounded in the house, and the clergyman dismissed him with his blessing to the back regions. More than any meal, to Simpson, was the pursuit of the game he was engaged in. The clergyman, who, he learned, was a most eligible bachelor, had two maids, a cook-housekeeper, and a help, who looked just like every stage and cinema tweeny,
They were delighted to welcome such a presentable male to their board, and in the hour that he took to his meal, Simpson learned more of lower-class suburbia than he had known in a whole lifetime spent among it. But beyond hearing that Mrs. Everett was a stuck-up widow who gave herself airs because her father had been a clergyman, he learned nothing that he wanted to know. When he asked if her father had been clergyman here, they said, oh no, that it had been somewhere in the north, some one-horse place, he might be sure. Mrs. Everett went to all the church meetings and things, the cook opined, not because she was keen on church, but just to keep everyone in mind that her father had been a clergyman. Revolving this really striking elucidation of human motive, Simpson went back to the garden to resume the mowing, which was very nearly finished, and presently the clergyman joined him again. They were having a social meeting in the church hall that evening. Would Simpson care to come? Simpson thanked him and said, with sincerity, that he would be delighted. In that case, there were chairs and such impedimenta to be carried from the church into the church hall. Would Simpson like to help with them? If he went down after tea, he would find the ladies' committee preparing for the event. A ladies' committee was the thing, above all, that Simpson wanted to meet at the moment, and he again expressed his complete willingness, and the clergyman departed. After an afternoon of border trimming and gossiping, alternately with the cook and the help, who invented excuses to come and talk to him, without apparently caring whether he believed the excuses or not, and a kitchen tea, which, though more productive than the previous day's one in Lemonora Road, lacked the spice provided by his colleague's presence, Simpson betook himself to the church. The church he had already located, a red brick building of a hideousness so complete that it was difficult to believe that it was accidental. The yellowish-brown and ultramarine blue of the stained-glass windows was now decently shrouded by the kindly dusk, but evening had its own horror in the brightly lit church hall, where two or three women were rushing about in the aimless, excited fashion of hens, talking much and achieving little, since none of their number did a thing without one of the others suggesting an amendment, which resulted in the committee immediately going into session. Their debates were protracted beyond the limits of an ordinary man's patience by their constant and insincere deferrings to each other, and after Simpson had watched them from the door for a little, very much as he had watched Mr. Caldecott's efforts with a lawnmower, he came slowly forward, cap in hand, and called attention to himself. "Are you looking for someone?" one of them said. And he explained that Mr. Caldecott had sent him down to assist. He was an immediate success. In fact, he was so sought after that he began to feel inordinately pleased with himself, a state of mind which has no business in a member of the Criminal Investigation Department, and which died a sudden death when later in the evening he met his rivals. Reporting them afterwards in camera to Mullins, he used a picturesqueness of phrase, which I regret I cannot reproduce, but which left no doubt in Mullins' mind as to the type of men who had attended that social. Altogether, Simpson was rather bitter about that evening, though why he should have been I cannot fathom. His red fair hair and freckles were his passport to happiness. No one could resist them. The pink wash that adorned the walls — it was raspberry with a touch of cochineal — did not presumably hurt him as it might have hurt more sensitive souls. He was by far the most popular male present, and the information he had come to seek was lying about in chunks, waiting to be picked up. But the fact remains that when the play was all over and Mullins said to him, "The boss is pleased with you about Brightling Crescent," Simpson's pleasant face twisted in a sneer that did not go with red hair and freckles, and he snarled. Yes, snarled. "Well, I sweated for it." The social broke up at the eminently respectable hour of 9:45, and Simpson once more helped the committee to play the game of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and then saw home the most gossiping of the females who had been nice to him, so that it was the following morning that Grant interviewed him and heard all that was to be known of Mrs. Everett. Mrs. Everett was Scotch. Her lack of accent was explained by the fact that she had been for 25 years in London, and that initially she came from the West Coast. Her father had been the minister of a wee free church in a village on the west coast of Ross, and now her brother was a minister there. Her name was Logan. She had been a widow for 15 years and had no children. She was not very popular because she kept herself to herself, but she was greatly respected. Not even the fact that she let her rooms to 2 bookmakers had been sufficient to degrade her in the eyes of the Brightlingside Congregational Church. Sorrel had gone to her on coming out of the army, and he had not been a bookmaker then, so perhaps she was absolved from any charge of deliberately choosing depravity as a boarder. The 2 men had not been known personally to any of the church community. They had been regarded from afar, Grant understood, as moral lepers without equal, but the subject of them seemed to have that never-palling attraction that thorough-paced wickedness has for virtue, and no detail of their lives was hidden from people whom the 2 men had quite certainly not known by sight. The 2 men, as Mrs. Everett had said— Mrs. Everett, Grant thought, would not lie about something that could be verified— went everywhere together. Neither had had a girl. They were both very smart, according to Brightlingside standards, and Mrs. Everett waited hand and foot on them. Mrs. Everett had no relations in London that anyone knew of, but once a year, usually, she went to Scotland, and if her boarders happened not to be away, engaged and paid someone to look after them. When Simpson had taken his burnished presence out of the room, Grant sent for the men who had been on duty at King's Cross and Euston on Monday night, and asked them to describe the suspects they had examined. At the King's Cross man's tale of a young man with his mother, he halted. "Describe the mother," he said, and the man did, quite accurately. "Were there no other possibilities on that train?" "Oh, yes," the man said, "several." He inferred bitterly that the original home of thin, dark men with high cheekbones must be the north of Scotland. They swarmed on all northbound trains. "What made you think he wasn't the man you wanted?" "His manner, sir, and the woman's, and his case was on the rack with the initials outside for anyone to see, GL, and he had a golf bag and altogether looked too casual." "Well done, Mrs. Everett," thought Grant. "It wasn't the man who left the notes in the drawer who thought of the golf bag." He wondered if leaving the case like that had been deliberate. He could hardly credit that anyone would risk unnecessarily the whole success of the thing on such an enormous bluff. It was probably accident. Where was he going? There were no labels on his luggage, but the ticket collector had said he was going to Edinburgh. It did not take Grant long to find out Lamont's probable destination. There were not many Logans in the Church of Scotland, and only one had a church in Russia. He was minister of the United Free Church in Carninish, having evidently ratted from the stern faith of his fathers, and Carninish was a village at the head of a loch on the west coast of the county. Grant went in to Barker and said, "I'm going fishing in Scotland for a day or two."
"There are more comfortable places than Scotland for hiding your diminished head," said Barker, who knew all about the arrest that had sideslipped.
"Maybe, but the fishing isn't so good. That's my approximate address. 2 days will do me, I expect."
"Taking anyone along?"
"No."
"I think you'd better. Think for a moment. What a Highland rural policeman is like. He can always kill the fish by falling on it, but I don't think it will come to that. I may want someone to take the fish to London, though."
"All right. When are you going?"
"I'm going with the 7:30 from King's Cross tonight, and I'll be in Inverness before 10 tomorrow morning. After that, I'll advise you."
"Right," said Barker. "Good fishing. Don't get stuck on your own hooks."
Grant spent a considerable time arranging for the prosecution of the search in his absence. He had no guarantee that the man who had gone to Carninish was Lamont. He was going after the suspect himself, because he was the only man among the searchers who had actually set eyes on the Dago. But the search in London would go on as usual. The whole departure for Carninish might be a huge bluff. Grant had a great respect for Mrs. Everett. As he was getting his fishing tackle together and looking out his old clothes, Mrs. Field came in with sandwiches and commiseration, neither of which Grant felt to be appropriate. He refused the former on the ground that he would have a very good dinner on the train and a very good breakfast, again on the train, in the morning.
"Yes," she said, "that's all very well, but look at the long night there'll be. You never know the minute you'll waken up hungry and be glad of the sandwiches, even if it's only to pass the time. They're chicken, and you don't know when you'll have chicken again. It's a terribly poor country, Scotland. Goodness only knows what you'll get to eat." Grant said that Scotland nowadays was very like the rest of Britain, only more beautiful.
"I don't know anything about beauty," said Mrs. Field, putting the sandwiches resolutely away in the rug strap. "But I do know that a cousin of mine was in service there once. She went for the season with her people from London, and there wasn't a house to be seen in the whole countryside but their own, and not a tree. And the natives had never heard of tea-cakes and called scones scones."
"How barbaric," said Grant, folding his most ancient tweed lovingly away in his case. As the train steamed out of King's Cross, he settled down to the study of a 1-inch survey map of the Carninish district. It gave him a pleasant feeling to be studying a map again. There was quite a distinctive thrill in hunting your man in open country. It was more primitive and more human, less mechanized than the soulless machinery that stretched and relaxed noiseless steel tentacles on Thames Bank. It was man against man. There would be a telephone only where there was a post office, and there would be no calling out of reserves to head off anyone making a break for it. It was your wit against his, perhaps your gun against his, but Grant hoped that it would not come to that. There would be little satisfaction in bringing a dead man to justice, and the police in any case do not look with favour on summary methods in their detectives. He would have to go about it quietly. After all, he was only 2 days behind the fare. The man could not have arrived at his destination before last night. The longer he had to settle down in, the less suspicious he would become. At first, every boulder would hide a detective for him, but as he grew used to the country, and Grant knew the type of country, its complete severance from any outside interests would have its inevitable effect of giving him a false sense of security. Grant studied the map. The village of Carninish lay along the south bank of a river, the Finlay, where the river joined the sea in Loch Finlay. About 4 miles to the south, a second loch ran into the land, and on the north shore of it was a village, slightly larger, apparently, than Carninish, called Garney. That is, Carninish lay on the north side of a peninsula, and Garney on the south, the distance between them over the peninsula being about 4 miles by a hilly and third-class road. Grant decided that he would stay at Garney. There was an hotel there which he knew from hearsay contained a bath, and from there he would keep an eye on Carninish under pretense of fishing the Finlay. Until late at night he pored over the map, until the country grew as familiar to him as if he had known it. He knew from bitter experience that the very best map reader had to suffer some severe shocks when he comes face to face with reality, but he had the comfortable knowledge that he now knew the district probably much better than the man he was hunting. And morning brought him nothing but exhilaration. As he opened his eyes on the daylight, through the open chink at the top of his window, he could see the brown moors sliding slowly past, and the chug-chug of the hitherto racing train told of its conquest of the Grampians. A clear, cold air that sparkled greeted him as he dressed, and over breakfast he watched the brown barrenness with its background of vivid sky and dazzling snow change to pine forest. Flat black slabs stuck mathematically on the hillsides like patches of woolwork, and then to birches, birches that stepped down the mountainsides as escort for some stream, or birches that trailed their light draperies of an unbelievable new green in little woods carpeted with fine turf. And so, with a rush, as the train took heart on the downgrade, to fields again, wide fields in broad straths and little stony fields tacked to hillsides, and lochs and rivers and a green countryside, he wondered, standing in the corridor, as the train rattled and swerved and swung in its last triumphant down-rush to Inverness, what the fugitive had thought of it all. The Londoner torn from his streets, and the security of buildings and bolt-holes. Sundays on the river would not have prepared him for the black torrents that waited him in the west, nor the freedom of a Surrey common for the utter unnerving desolation of those moors. Had he regretted his flight? He wondered what the man's temperament was. He had been the bright and cheerful one, at least according to Mrs. Everett. Was he anything more than bright and cheerful? He had cared sufficiently for something to stab a man in the back for it, but that did not argue sensitiveness. To a sensitive man, the horror of being alone and helpless and hunted in a country like this would probably be worse than a cell of familiar bricks and mortar. In the old days in the Highlands, to take to the hills had been synonymous with flying from justice, what the Irish call being on the run. But civilization had changed that completely. Not one criminal in a thousand now fled to the Highlands or to Wales for refuge. A man demanded the means of food and shelter in his retreat nowadays, and a deserted bothy or a cave on the hillside were out of date. If it had not been for Mrs. Everett's promise of sanctuary, not even her will would have got Lamont out of London. Grant felt sure of that. What had Lamont felt when he saw what he had come to? At Inverness he left the comfort of the through train and crossed the wind-swept platform into a little local affair that for the rest of the morning trundled from the green countryside back into a brown desolation such as had greeted Grant on waking. West and still farther west they trailed, stopping inexplicably at stations set down equally inexplicably in the middle of vast moors devoid of human habitation, until in the afternoon he was bundled out onto a sandy platform and the train went away into the desolation without him. Here he was told he took the mail car. It was 36 miles to Carninish, and with any luck he'd be there by 8 the night. It would all depend on how many things they met on the road. It wasn't but a fortnight back that Andy had had the right wheel in the front taken clean off of him by another motor car, and him with the left wheel half into the ditch and all. Grant was led through a booking office, and in the gravel space behind the station beheld the contraption in which he was to spend the next 5 hours, and which would, with luck on the road, duly deposit him in Garney. It was quite literally a charabanc. Behind the driving seat were 3 benches, their penitential qualities inadequately mitigated by cushions, stuffed, apparently, with sawdust and covered in American cloth. There were, amazing as it seemed to him, 5 other candidates for seats on this conveyance. Grant made inquiries about hiring a car to do the journey, and the expressions on the faces of his audience conveyed to him not only the futility of his quest, but the fact that he had been guilty of a grave error of taste. One did not scorn the mail car. It was the one significant thing in each day to the dwellers in the 36 miles between him and the sea. Grant resigned himself to discomfort, and hoped that comedy would save the journey from boredom. So far, comedy had been absent from him. He begged a seat by the driver and hoped for the best. As they went along the narrow roads, torn here and there where burns had swept across them in their downward path in spate from the hills, he realized the force of the man's remark about meeting things. There was no room in most places for even a perambulator to pass. "How do you manage when you meet something?" he asked the driver.